This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Think about it. Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books.
Welcome. I'm sitting here with Professor Dora Zhang. So first of all, thank you, Dora, for making time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to introduce you briefly, and then we're sitting here in Wheeler Hall at the University of California at Berkeley. It's a beautiful, sunny November day. Blue skies. I walked to the Redwood Grove up here. It's kind of the good life in California. And you're teaching a class right now at the University of California called The Good Life. And before that, I just want to introduce you. So you're a scholar of what we call modernism, probably sort of Anglo-American European literatures. Your book, Strange Likeness, Description in the Modernist Novel, looks at how description is something much more interesting than just describing the world around us or the scene in a novel, but it actually carries other dimensions besides just setting up a scenario. And you've written on Proust and photography, Wolf, and you publish also in sort of more sort of mainstream non-academic places, LA Review books, etc. And at Berkeley right now, you're teaching a class called The Good Life. Can you tell me a little bit about the idea behind this class and what motivates you to go in and talk to students about the good life?
Yeah. I think it was born in part out of an earlier literature and philosophy class that I taught in the English department, which I organized around three main questions, which were: who are we? What can we know? And how should we live? And, you know, we have one semester to cover this, so obviously very selective. And I found, you know, there was a lot of interest in this, in the section where we talked about how should we live. And I think that, so I sort of wanted to have a class that was kind of just on that question, but that also moved away from purely the sort of ethics and moral philosophy where that question is more often asked, and thinking about, you know, what can literature tell us about this, but also how can we think about that question in relation to the kind of historical material circumstances that we find ourselves in, which, you know, these philosophical inquiries tend to be less concerned about, right? They're operating at a level of abstraction that's not always attuned to historical specificities. So I was also, you know, I have in several times taught and been very influenced by the work of Lauren Berlant, and particularly Cruel Optimism, like a lot of people. And so my thinking for this class of The Good Life was sort of inspired by these dual kind of forces. So I was thinking about fantasies of the good life and, you know, what is it that keeps us attached to fantasies of the good life, even when they, you know, may be obstacles to our flourishing, as Berlant says about Cruel Optimism, which really is a book in many ways about the good life and about fantasies of the good life. And when I started, you know, looking into this, I was just Googling like other people's classes on the good life, and I found a lot of classes that were, you know, the kind of happiness 101,
right?
Or like habits, like how to inculcate, you know, good habits.
Like the science of happiness,
yes,
the positive psychology, very
exactly.
Popular college courses right now.
Very so popular.
Very much written up. I think Yale University offers one. At
exactly.
NYU, where I teach, it is supposed to have the longest waiting list of all the classes and choices. So they're positive psychology, maximize yourself, increase your performance, get up in the morning, drink water, meditate, make your bed, get dressed, and you'll have a good day.
Exactly.
Not to caricature this, but there's a kind of optimization of yourself.
Exactly. Yes, it's all about kind of how to optimize ourselves as much as possible, right? And that's sort of what the idea of a good life is. And so I wanted to approach it from a more critical angle, as I think, you know, is standard or at least much more common in the humanities. But I wanted to also think about, I wanted to take seriously, though, the desire for that kind of, you know, for that kind of optimization or that desire for, you know, better opportunities, kind of better version of yourself.
Right.
And I think it's also very easy to just heap scorn on that and to sort of see it as hollow or sort of vulgar in some way. And I think there are all kinds of issues with the sort of very naive optimism of that kind of approach.
Right.
But there's something too about that desire, you know, that I think is important to take seriously and to not simply and to sort of treat without contempt. So that's kind of the line that I was trying to walk. And I tell my students in this class on the first day that this is not a happiness 101 class.
Right.
So that they, you know, because a lot of it is actually kind of a bummer. A lot of what we need is a bummer. So, you know, I don't want them to think that we're sort of just going to have this class where we try to figure out like how to be our best selves.
But you don't want to take that away, this kind of aspiration, or we all want to be happy.
Yeah.
Right. We know from not only from people like Freud, but probably from ourselves, that we're often not quite so happy, although we know our conditions. Let's assume right now we're sitting in a Berkeley office. Mm-hmm. So let's assume we're taking out extreme poverty, real deprivation, like conditions that are really so inalterable or so overwhelming that there's not even a conversation about the good life.
Right.
So the word good, then, you said much a little while ago, in philosophy, it would probably be moral philosophy or ethics, how to be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't quite only mean that, right? It's not just how to be a good person in the community with others.
Right. No, definitely. And I think it is very much about sort of how do we think about these very kind of individual personal questions, which I think is one way we often think about the question of the good life. On the level of individual behavior or, you know, personal ambition or personal goals. How do we think about that in light of the kinds of, you know, actual historical material circumstances that people find themselves in? Who is less, you know, who is excluded from the possibility of achieving the good life, or for whom is that possibility, you know, more attractive because of, you know, I don't know, certain narratives or where they're coming from or whatever it may be. So it is very much about emphasizing the kind of larger external forces and not just the sort of individual or the question of character or personal ethics.
Which would be the ultimately an abstraction in a way. It's sort of the subject or the individual.
Yes, exactly.
And can you say a little bit more about Lauren Berlant's work? So there's a book called Cruel Optimism, which is a kind of very long, sustained critique of our attachment to this idea of the good life. Mm-hmm. And she also says, I'm not dismissing this. I just want to take apart where this attachment becomes a problem. And she was a professor at the University of Chicago. So they passed away, I think, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, or just very recently.
Very
actually.
Recently.
Yeah.
Really great loss for everybody. Yeah, so really great loss. And that book has been a very influential book for people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it has been a very influential book for people. It's actually very interesting to me to see the outpouring of kind of grief, which I also felt. I mean, I didn't know Berlant at all personally, so no personal relationship with them, but the outpouring in the wake of their death was really quite striking to me. I think because this, obviously Berlant has a very large body of work, is important in many fields, and you know, I came to it through the field of affect theory, but I think cruel optimism in particular just like named something, a kind of, you know, a structure of feeling, to use Raymond Williams' term, that just struck a chord with many people. And I think, you know, it's historically specific. It's kind of about the breakdown of you know, the welfare state and in the post-war period, but really in the last few decades, it's very kind of focused on the contemporary period. And I think it's something that the students, that my students, but my students definitely connect to, I think, because those promises of, you know, prosperity, of just economic stability, of kind of a decent paying job, of health insurance, of home ownership, all of these things are so much less less possible or less within their grasp. So, but at the same time, you know, there's nothing that still continues to be the kind of normative ideal.
Is the good life, can it be mapped onto the American dream as an idea, sort of this upward mobility, everyone can make it? If you're sort of bootstrap your way out of it, mm-hmm. if you work hard, opportunities abound, mm-hmm. you'll realize your potential, you'll own a home, you'll raise mm-hmm. a family, you'll be yeah. safe and secure.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's very tied to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think our kind of fantasy of the good life is very closely related to something like the American dream. Yeah, yeah. And we do talk about that quite a lot in the class.
Can you say one thing just for our listeners?
Sure.
You said the structure of feeling. Can you just tease that apart a little bit, what that means?
Sure.
What is the structure of feeling?
Right. So I mean, Raymond Williams uses this term to name something that kind of is something that's still very emergent, that isn't captured by just talking about institutions and kind of formal structures, but that you know, indexes a historical moment, but that is still very kind of nascent and a little inchoate, and that captures something that escapes purely, you know, analysis in terms of like structures and policies.
Okay, and there, and to go back to this cruel optimism book. So this book is trying to say we're attached to the good life.
Mm-hmm.
It's understandable. I think the book's strength is that Lauren Balance says it's understandable we attach to it. We want this.
Right.
But this want or this desire gets in our own way.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually an obstacle to our flourishing. So and I think that's the phrase that Berlant uses, that that a relationship of cruel optimism obtains, you know, that not all optimism is cruel, but a relationship of cruel optimism obtains when the thing that we desire is a kind of obstacle to our own flourishing. And I think, yeah, there's something about that that's so immediately relatable, to use a term
that
my students use a lot. So you can sort of see it play out in all kinds of domains, right? Both in this kind of larger political stage, but also in personal relationships as well. And we see that in a lot of the works that we read in these different ways.
So after you tell the students in the first class, this is not about maximizing your happiness course.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in the second class when do you let them or introduce them to?
Right. So we actually start off with Antigone, which is a little bit of an outlier from the other texts. It's in part because I want to have some range, because it's also an introduction to comparative literature. So I want to have some range. And I've just found Antigone such a rich text to teach. But I put that as part of a unit on just I forget the name of the title of this now, but something like, what should we do? Or it's sort of like it's a conflict between different ethical systems,
different
worldviews. I kind of start out by saying, well, if we think that for most of us, you know, the idea of the good life entails acting appropriately, right? Sort of doing the right thing. That's what it is. It's called doing the right thing. That's the unit. So, you know, it entails, among other things, doing the right thing. But what do you do when you have this kind of conflict when it's not clear what it means to do the right thing, or when doing the right thing in one domain, you know, results
right.
in kind of difficulties or troubles in another domain. So I use that as a way. So that's kind of a more standard, in many ways, sort of the more like ethical, more
right.
philosophical approach. So I start with that, and then sort of move on to other
I assume
things.
It's really that makes it really palpable to students that there's a conflict between what you want to do as an individual versus
yeah.
what you're obligated to do as part of a community, because there's a law, there's a moral obligation. So Antigone has to bury her brother. Then there's a legal obligation. You can't do it. So you have, it's kind of dramatizes this conflict.
Yeah.
How does it end in Antigone? I'm trying to remember.
How does it end?
Yeah.
Everyone dies.
Oh, okay.
Antigone dies.
So what do you tell the students then? This is the solution to this dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an intractable problem, right? I think we have had no happy ending so far. We may end with one happy ending, but it is very much, I mean, one of the main conflicts is, and one way that it's often been understood is the conflict between the individual and the state,
right.
or the community. So, I mean, you can think about it in terms of the community or the state as the sort of authoritarian reading of Creon, Antigone's
right.
uncle, the king, who, you know, says this is the law of the polis.
Right.
Enemies can't receive burial.
Right.
So I think that we see this through Antigone sort of different ways of articulating the conflict
yeah.
and, I give them this reading by this essay by Bonnie Honig, who's now a political philosopher, who's actually, I think, also now written a book that is on Antigone, but this is an earlier essay where she contextualizes it she discusses it in the context of democracy in 5th century Athens, the time of
yeah.
Sophocles' writing, and sort of makes this very counterintuitive case that Creon is actually the embodiment of democracy in principle, but not in process. Like, he's not, you know, doesn't
wow.
solicit people's opinions
yeah.
in a democratic fashion, but he kind of embodies this democratic principle of treating everybody the same,
right.
you know, which also has the flip side that everyone is interchangeable. So he's rejecting the kind of singularity and uniqueness of the individual
yeah.
Antigone wants to uphold. So this to me is like a really interesting kind of counterintuitive reading. So
that's amazing. Yeah, yeah.
The students with that, which they don't normally, their sympathies much more tend to be on the side of Antigone. But actually I find often that they sort of just want to, they see both Antigone and Creon as being, single-minded and sort of blind to the other
right.
perspective. So they actually kind of take a very Hegelian view.
Attached to an ideal. Or so
yeah.
They become attached to an ideal that's almost outside of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're unable to find
yeah.
kind of some
yeah.
compromise. So they often actually, they often sort of advocate for a compromise or see compromise as
right.
A desirable.
It's a great opening of her class also when you just mentioned that Creon is Antigone's uncle, that I think that makes that in one play there's so many different levels and dimensions, and so there's a relation between them that's familial, but
yeah.
is it going to be broken? Then it's
right.
the state versus the individual, women versus men,
right.
death versus life.
Right,
so,
right.
But they can't be resolved really on one side or the other.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and Creon is, right, Creon doesn't die at the end. I shouldn't say
right.
that everyone dies.
Yeah.
Creon doesn't die at the end. And there is perhaps some sense that he may go on to be actually affected by this and sort of change
right.
his his authoritarian ways, but...
Let me ask you a really naive question. It's might not a classicist question. So what do you think Sophocles' audience was... What did he expect them to get from a play like this? Because
mm-hmm.
this is their world. For us, this is so old, and it's
mm-hmm.
such an old play, and
mm-hmm.
we think, oh, it's classics.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people at
yeah.
some point confronted with this for whom this was the present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and so, I mean, I'm by no means a scholar of classics, but... My understanding is that, you know, that, I mean, so the play is set in this kind of mythical time of Thebes,
right.
which is not the present of Sophocles' own time, but he would, his audience would absolutely have been understanding it as commentary on their own time and the transition to democracy and this kind of entire shift in worldviews, you know, from rule by a few families to, you know, rule by a much more, much more, a more egalitarian system. I mean, of course, democracy, Athenian democracy excluded many people, women, slaves, etc. But yeah, so I think they would have seen it as kind of working through some of these problems and sort of both both a kind of a grappling with what it means to transition from, you know, this one kind of worldview that privileges family ties, individuals, compared to another that privileges ties to the one's duties as a citizen and as a member of the polis, and also seeing the limitations of that as well.
Where do you go after Antigone?
So then we move to Madame Bovary.
Okay.
So like quite a jump.
So we go from, when is Sophocles? This is the
5th century BC.
5th century BC to the 1850s.
Yeah, 50s, I think, yeah.
So Flaubert's writing Madame Bovary. Okay.
Is it the 1840s, 40s or 50s?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sort of forgetting. Yeah, so then we have a kind of unit on something like, I don't know, like dreams of the good life or something. And that's very focused on these characters and the kind of, you know, the desire for something better, you know, these characters who are constantly lusting after something better, which is actually also very tied up with their desire for material goods.
Sure.
And so, yeah, Madame Bovary, we spend a few weeks on Madame Bovary. And
what does she want? Emma Bovary. Sort of, it's a question about a woman in the mid 19th century, and Flaubert is very interesting. It's a male novelist in France, and he identifies completely with her, very famously, like Madame Senoir.
Yeah.
And he writes about what she wants, and it becomes a novel. I think that people read, like, what does the 19th century want?
Mm-hmm.
After you have, to summarize this, you have the French Revolution, you have some kind of more egalitarian society, mm-hmm. but people are left kind of wanting something for themselves.
Yeah, and so we talk about it in the context of the rise of the bourgeoisie and kind of the rise of capitalism. And, you know, Emma Bovary is this bourgeois woman who, you know, really a member of the petty bourgeoisie, though, who, you know, country doctor, that's her husband, and who sees, you know, these kind of aristocrats. Who goes to, you know, a very formative moment when she goes to a ball in the first section and sees that, you know, even like their skin is better or something. They're like thoroughbreds. I mean, these are, you know, really amazing descriptions. And, you know, she's sort of very susceptible to romantic fantasies that she reads in novels, right? She's a kind of latter day Quixote in a way. She kind of has like made the mistake of thinking that literature is life. And so, yeah, I mean, she wants these things. I mean, I think what's so interesting about the novel is that in part through, or in no small part really, through kind of Flaubert's use of irony, for which he's so famed, he can really present he can present her desires, the content of her desires, as, you know, totally banal and kind of cliche and conventional. You know, she wants you know, kisses by moonlight and like a lover to come out on the balcony and sing to her and toss her roses, like, you know, this kind of thing. And she wants like nice dresses and, you know, fashionable serving bowls and these kinds of things. So, you know, I think he's very, he's ironic, or he's kind of critical. He's not even, he's just say he's ironic about the content of her desires, but I think there's something also really moving about the fact of her desire and sort of the intensity of her desire. And there's also, I think, something quite transgressive about that. I mean, and you know, I have students who often point out, well, I think what she really wants is something like freedom and autonomy, which is not available to her as a woman in this time. But not that she's articulating it in those terms, but so there's something at once, you know, kind of sort of something kind of mocking in the novel's treatment of her, and at the same time, you know, sympathetic.
Right.
And it's that knife's edge between
you know,
pathos and irony that makes Flaubert so kind of amazing.
But that's so important. What you said about Laurent Berland's work, it doesn't dismiss these desires.
Right.
And the simplicity of being condescending and saying people want a fancy car, or they want to have Kylie Jenner's makeup, or they want to have a fancy dress, or they want to go to, you know, a night in a fancy hotel. It's not illegitimate to have that.
Right.
And some of it, so what you're talking about more is what gives rise to this desire? How does it shape their lives? How does it influence it? Rather than what's the object itself?
Right.
The object has significance, but it's not about ridiculing the object.
Right.
Because also we could all have different desires. And it's like, you know, I may like this car and you may not like a car at all. You want another bike or something.
Right.
And so it's easy to sort of dismiss the object, but leave everything else intact.
And I find that the students really respond differently to Emma. You know, some of them are more sympathetic. Some of them see her as very kind of selfish and narcissistic, which she is. You know, I think that she's also not maternal. I think this is important, and this is something that is, for some of the students, something they find very damning about her.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's also interesting to kind of just think about, like, how we treat desires and, you know, women's desires in this case, how that, what's kind of acceptable and what's, beyond the pale. Yeah.
And it's hard to accept in a way that a woman could have desires that conflict with her presumably assigned role of being a mother.
Yeah.
And then so why would she have this role if the father could have all sorts of desires, for example?
Right. Yeah. That's, I think, one of the things that's kind of transgressive about her. Yeah.
Where do you go after Madame Bovary?
So then so in a previous iteration of the class, we also read The Great Gatsby, ended up not doing it this semester, but there, I think it follows on very naturally from Madame Bovary, because then there's sort of more on the idea of the American dream, and The Great Gatsby is so central to that kind of mythology, as kind of the embodiment both of the American dream and also the critique of the American dream. So, so we do that, and that really kind of also ties into the sort of a later moment of many of the same kind of conflicts, or the relationship between like the bourgeoisie and the desire for the emulation of the aristocracy and new money and old money. You really see that playing out in The Great Gatsby as well, and the place of objects and the kind of, the sort of fetishistic power that objects can have is there as well.
It's such an amazing book, I think, that it is sort of one of the great American novels.
Yeah.
And it's such a severe kind of deconstruction of the American dream, for sure. And then I think it's very hard to even think about The Great Gatsby without Leonardo DiCaprio getting in the way, I feel. The images are really, or the earlier ones, I guess, Robert Redford or something. But there's something about I don't even know if it's a tragedy, but the kind of brutality of that book.
Yeah.
It's just stunning
in
a way. And it's sort of, it's considered, this is a great celebration of this good life.
Like, that like good the life, boring 20s.
Yeah. That good life is really harsh on most people, including himself, including, of course, he ends up not in a good place. You're dead in the pool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which I think sort of sometimes I start my students out by saying, you know, let's wait where he ends up.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an identification with him.
Right.
As the achiever,
right. Exactly.
The one who made it, the one who overcame his roots kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's funny how to shift students' attention to the Buchanans.
Oh, yeah.
And how horrible they really are.
Right.
And they're really the American dream
right.
that he wants
right.
to be part of.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the society he wants access to. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot in it. And it's one of the texts that a lot of them are likely to have read it in high school.
Right.
So the hope is that they will see something different
right.
this time. But yeah, I hesitated, you know, to put it on the syllabus because I feel like, oh, they've all read it. It's sort of so, it's so kind of entered, you know,
it's
national consciousness.
Right. It's like an archetype somehow.
Yeah.
You can almost not take it apart.
Yeah. But then I sort of felt like, well, if you're going to talk about the American dream, this is really a good place to talk about it because it's so much
right.
Part feeds so much into right. that mythology.
So what else do you do instead of the Gatsby now?
Then, so I actually just took that out this semester
yeah.
because, and we had like various classes that we were missing. So it just ended up working on the syllabus. And then we do A Raisin in the Sun, the play by Lorraine Hansberry.
Lorraine Hansberry's play. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also, you know, about the American dream.
Right.
Sort of this other side of who is, you know.
Can you just tell us quickly what the plot is of that? It's
sure.
amazing. Like, it's the late 50s or something?
Yeah, it's like mid 50s.
57
yeah.
or 50 or something like that.
And it's about this family, the younger family,
yeah.
who live in the south side of Chicago in kind of a slum. The matriarch of the family, the father who's died, his death has provided a $10,000 insurance check. And
right.
so there's sort of conflict about how to use this money. It can be really transformative. The son, Walter, wants to use it to buy a liquor store. And the mother, you know, has this dream of buying a house and ends up buying a house in a white neighborhood, in a white working class neighborhood, but in a white neighborhood. And, you know, a member of that neighborhood comes and tries to kind of buy them out and says, you know, you're not actually really welcome here.
Because they're an African-American family.
Because they're a black
I don't even
family.
Think
oh,
we
yeah,
pointed
sorry.
This out. So Lorraine Hansberry
yes.
is writing
yes.
about the aspiration of a post-war African-American
exactly.
family that real estate is the gateway to
yes.
economic independence and freedom in a certain
yes.
way.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
So they kind of end up not selling and moving into the house. But it's, you know, it's a very, I think it's actually a much more ambiguous ending than is often and sort of sometimes I think thought of as a triumphant ending. You know, they stood up for their dignity,
right.
they're moving to the house. But I think it's sort of there's a real suggestion that there's something, you know, ominous things are going to happen. They're going to meet with real violence, you know.
Right, right, right.
It's not happy in the sense that racial strife has been overcome or
right.
that discrimination has been overcome or that they're going to
right.
now be happy there even. So I think it's a really brilliant play. It was a huge commercial success
yes.
as well. And it's a very engaging play and very sort of accessible, but I think it's it also is complexity and nuance in a way that may not even be immediately
obvious. Also the mother-son conflict is really hard
yes.
because everybody wants to either live out the supposed legacy of the father or shift and
mm-hmm.
be something new.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the sense that I don't want to do what your conventional,
right.
somewhat cautious approach.
Right.
This
right.
is America. You got to try something.
Right.
You got to
right.
wage or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the son and Walter could be read, you know, as a sort of like Gatsby and kind of wanting to,
right.
You know, to break the mold to sort of, you know, he has these aspirations of upward mobility. And they're specifically around enterprise and kind of entrepreneurship and, you know, and owning a business
right.
And making money. So
right,
it's
right,
sort
right.
of this one set of like very capitalist values. And then the mother kind of offers, I think, an alternative set of values, and there are, and you know, each of the characters, then there's also a younger sister, Benita, who's
right.
very forward-thinking and feminist and Pan-Africanist,
right.
And then there's Walter's wife. So there, it's really an ensemble piece that has a lot of, it's very humanist in its kind of sympathies for all of the different characters and all of their different desires and their different visions of what it means to do something big, which is something that, you know, a number of the younger family sort of want to do.
And it's also interesting that the good life or the American dream, is it to opt into a kind of structure that exists? So
right.
If you buy real estate, you're going to move up, et cetera. You're going to get a good job with the pension, et cetera. You're going to move up. But then this makes clear, this isn't available to lots of people,
right.
Even before the 70s, before the state dismantles all sorts of public services, like lots of things are not available. And the question is the good life, is it something that requires individual actions outside of what the common understanding is what you should be doing?
Mm-hmm.
Do you need to actually strike out in a certain way to become independent? And then good is no longer this kind of moral obligation toward others, but toward yourself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that post-war context, I mean, you know, the GI Bill and, you know, policies like subsidized housing effectively and the kind of the building of suburban lots. I mean, this is what kind of actually gave birth to that particular vision of the American dream that we're so, the white picket fence that we're so familiar with.
Yeah.
And that's also the time of, you know, redlining and kind of exclusion of African-Americans from all of those kinds of policies. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think, yes, there's a question about what, is it possible to kind of, to is it even possible to sort of have your own, to articulate your own vision of the good life or to pursue something that isn't just, you know, this kind of normative model or what's available to you? And I think some of the characters see that or see that possibility.
It's like the first section of Michael Cunningham's The Hours, his rewriting of Mrs. Dalloway, where a woman's possibility for the good life in the 50s is total conformity. Ultimately, you become a perfect housewife. You wait when the husband comes home in the evening. You have baked a cake and everything is beautiful. So is the good life a prescriptive thing that you have to buy into or mold? And then Raisin in the Sun shows that, well, it doesn't apply to lots of people. It doesn't apply to an entire gender. It doesn't apply to all these other people. So is it really the American dream is a kind of distortion of that? It's a very specific, I think Ta-Nehisi Coates in Between the World and Me criticizes the dream. He calls it capital D always, the dream. He says, this is just a charade. This is actually a pernicious trap for people to buy into because it excludes all sorts of other people. So where do you go after Raisin in the Sun?
So then I think we read, I think this is where we go next. Yeah, I think then we read The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is, so we're sort of moving forward in time and kind of end, you know, well, first we move, into quite the contemporary and then we end in a kind of with a science fiction work. But The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which kind of continues a lot of these ideas with, you know, and sort of introduces this character of Changez, who's a Pakistani immigrant and goes to Princeton and then works at this elite management consulting firm that's a kind of McKinsey stand-in. And then 9/11 happens and he, you know, suddenly becomes kind of suspect, but also his family in Pakistan, you know, Pakistan is destabilized. You know, it may looks like war with India might be looming. And so he ends up kind of leaving, going back to Pakistan. And this whole story is told from the perspective of Changez to an unnamed American interlocutor in Lahore. And there's just kind of a narrative ambiguity that's sustained throughout the novel about what who's actually a threat to whom and whether the American might be there to be on a mission to like kill him or something, or whether he might be on a mission to kill the American. So,
This is you went to Princeton as for graduate school. And he comes out of Princeton as the, this is really the sort of the factory to churn out Little Gatsby's.
It's
like you make people who are going to make it big in Manhattan, work McKinsey or Bain or one of those things. And then he starts to doubt whether he's doing the right thing by imposing this very American corporate profit model on himself and on these companies. And there's a crisis of conscience, which is really nice. And then it's related to a woman, this woman, which my students always find it kind of remarkable that her name is Erica.
Right.
Which is part of
America.
I know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a nice moment, actually. It's sort of, it is really kind of a big moment in the book where you say, oh, it's I am America.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Erica, and he's attached, but she's actually a very brittle, fragile, tormented person in a way, which is interesting. So America is not the ideal, the happy place.
Right.
And it's not just because he's a Pakistani background or something. It's really the place itself is corrupt, I think, right? It's a really hard book to because after 9/11, he says the place is just holding on to some kind of threadbare idea of capitalism. There's just hurting people everywhere.
Yes, there's a real critique of nostalgia, the nostalgia of that of that moment. Yeah. And the kind of backwardness or the kind of holding on to something in that a vision of the past that doesn't exist anymore. And it, you know, it says, what is that vision exactly? Is it a vision of security, of kind of integrity prior to some sort of violation?
Right.
You know? And she's holding on, this woman, Erica's holding on to this. This dead ex-boyfriend, she's like her first love. So it's also a time before you're touched by mortality and loss. Absolutely. She's so much an allegory for the nation.
It's interesting. It was written in the 2000s or something.
Yeah, I think it's 2007.
2007, I believe. So Mohsin Hamid. And then you just said something which made me think of the Trump campaign, of course, Make America Great Again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of
nostalgic.
It's a throwback to an ideal.
Yeah.
And in some ways, people say this ideal has been compromised.
Right.
And this book is about whether the ideal was ever real or not.
Right, right.
And maybe it was real for some people.
Right. I think for some people, I mean, and then he wonders, did this you know, country have a place for me anymore?
Right.
And so,
right.
I think we're back at this idea that it worked for some people, but... Not
and this is, I think, a good, exactly, like what we said earlier, it generates a lot of energy in people, this ideal. Whether the ideal actually itself is to be critiqued, that's not quite the point so much.
Right,
but what does it produce in people?
Right, right. This enormous attachment.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's a great line in that book when he says, I arrived in New York from Pakistan. I became a New Yorker in that moment, but I never became an American.
Yes. Yeah,
he says he's allowed to be this person, which is a fantasy about New York, which is probably also incorrect in a way, you know. But I'm interested that this ideal of America, the book is not supposed to say, I think, the ideal is inherently wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What people make of it,
mm-hmm.
because I'm trying to just ask you a question. I think, do you think these books are trying to take away all these ideals, like wealth for Gatsby, for Madame Bovary, living a fancy life and having beautiful clothes and good skin, or for the reluctant fundamentalist to be a wolf on Wall Street, make lots of money, have a beautiful girlfriend? It's not about those things. It's more what we do with our attachments to various things.
I think that's a good question. You know, is it just kind of taking them away? Is it just about stripping away of illusions? And I think, you know, this is why the class is a bummer in a lot of ways, because it is a lot of kind of stripping away of these illusions. But I think a really important question that, you know, that we keep, that I try to kind of keep sight of is how to balance how to maintain a balance between something like structure and kind of agency of sort of like individual personal agency and, you know, these larger structural economic or, you know, political forces that we have no control over, because I think there is a lot of emphasis on, and in all of these books, there's a lot of emphasis on, and in our readings of these books, emphasis on how these larger forces affect, you know, our desires and whether we're able to achieve those desires and what we even want in the first place. But, you know, I think something in your question makes me think of is just, well, what do you do? You can't just take them away from people, you know?
Or you will, but they will attach to other things.
Right.
You can take away the idea of home ownership for this family.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to want something because we want something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's Lauren Berlant's idea of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
She said it's anything that's directed outward, directed towards something.
Mm-hmm. It's a kind of reaching towards. It's an attachment.
And
yeah.
Even if you blow up this fantasy, you're going to be like Gatsby and say, oh, actually, you're going to be really unhappy and end up dead in a pool.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to want, they're not going to get, people are not going to lose their ability to desire something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they could desire something else, the
right.
revolution,
right.
overthrow, whatever. They
right.
could desire Bernie Sanders, I don't
right.
know, AOC.
Right.
Like there's
right.
always other attachments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's also about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we need certain attachments.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. I think I sort of emphasize that less, but I think that you're right. I mean, yes, we do need to have those attachments. You can't just kind of, you don't just, even if you take away the object, you don't take away the need for those objects.
I think
so. The objects sort of give us meaning. They
right.
kind of, you know, determine our sort of purpose of action in a lot of ways. And yeah, and I've been thinking about it in terms of like, what kind of, for any individual kind of agency do they have in the light of these larger forces, you know? So if we've kind of clarified
right.
the effects of these larger forces, where does that leave you? Are you, is it just fatalistic? Is it
right.
deterministic? It can't be, right? And I think that's part of that's also part of what I came to realize in teaching it the first time, that I was really sort of invested in a kind of like critical mode
right.
of demystification. And the students were just kind of, I mean, they saw that, but they weren't content with that. I mean, they wanted still to hold on to something.
Right, right,
and,
right.
And
yes.
to hold on also to the idea of personal agency. I mean,
yes.
I think, and I just came to realize how important that was to acknowledge and to talk about, and to talk about that dynamic, because it's just not sufficient to just be like, well, you know, you're constrained by your time and by these larger forces.
Well, it's also kind of it's what you're saying, it denies agency.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, it's hopeless, it's futile. You
yeah.
want to own a home. There's
right.
redlining. There's
right.
going to be
exactly.
racist neighborhoods. You
yeah.
won't make it.
Right.
You can't tell people that.
Right. Right.
You can't even tell a woman in 1850s
right.
you shouldn't have nice
right.
clothes.
Right.
Because
right.
there's also, that to me sounds a little bit like, as if then everybody becomes equal, like the proletariat,
mm-hmm.
and must desire the revolution,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is a self-transformation,
mm-hmm.
which is,
right.
which is,
right.
and you don't exist as a self, but you have a greater goal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, your students are, because what do you take, like after Gatsby, after Raisin in the Sun, after Reluctant Fundamentalist, what do you hold on to? The book is Reluctant Fundamentalist. Yes, you said the ending is so ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't know how it ends. There's also a movie, I think Mira Nair
yeah,
made this great
right.
movie.
I haven't seen it.
Which
yeah.
is, which is kind of useful. I make my students sometimes write about the book
oh, really?
And the movie because
uh-huh.
the ending is different.
Oh, really?
So
oh.
I can find out. I said, you have to read the book because the ending will be different.
Interesting.
She does something else in the ending.
Oh,
it's kind of interesting.
Okay.
But it's what we're talking about is what you said much earlier, kind of a structure of feeling or kind of this, we are moved in the world to participate in the world.
Yeah.
We attach to all sorts of things
right.
and fantasies, and many of them are bad. Or,
right.
or they're actually... like a ruse, like a trick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like, oh, you'll buy a house.
Right.
You'll be forever indebted. Great.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's actually college, I think, is really, it's
yes.
having suffering because people are saying,
yeah,
you're going to get this college degree and spend
right.
$250,000 or,
right.
you know, University of California, if you're resident, it's
right.
cheaper, but
right.
it's a fortune for what?
Right.
The promise was social mobility. You're going to
exactly.
get a good job.
Yeah.
Great career.
Right.
That's no longer guaranteed.
Right.
So how do you, once you've stripped that away,
mm-hmm.
then people are standing saying, well, what should I want now?
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So what do you tell them?
Well, yes,
yeah.
I'm like, good question. So, and then we end with The Dispossessed, which is a science fiction novel by Ursula Le Guin,
yeah.
Which is a kind of utopian.
I have not read, so I don't
it's,
know.
It's
yeah.
really wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a kind of utopian, but very complicated, you know, a novel that imagines this other planet, these two twin planets, and a physicist from one of them goes to the other one, and one is actually just what kind of broke off from the other one. It was kind of a utopian, founded by a utopian rebel, and it's an anarchist society. And then the other kind of the older one that this anarchist society broke off from, that planet is of a capitalist planet.
Yeah.
So this, you know, this pretext of a physicist, a visitor from one, they've had no contact for like hundreds of years, although they have some trade. And then this physicist goes to this other, to the capitalist planet and kind of visits it. And it's very complicated, but it's a really brilliant, I think, imagining of these alternate modes of social organization.
Yeah.
It's not at all simplistic. I mean, it's not at all a kind of, I think it's not clear which is the utopia, and that's kind of the main point. And it's, you know, she was reading Kropotkin. I mean, she was sort of like quite steeped in anarchist theory, which is something that I think we don't often know very much about. I mean, I'm not an expert in this either, but we sort of just think of it as like lawlessness and, you know, lack of order. But it's very, I mean, it involves a lot of like coordination and organization if you actually try to set up an anarchist society. And there's very, there are very strict kind of rules that, that have to be followed in order for it to work. I mean, not rules in terms of like what behavior, but, you know, the infrastructure kind of has to be there in a way.
Right.
So, it's a really just brilliant kind of exploration of all of these different elements. And so I think I end there because I think speculative fiction can really help us think about, you know, the possibility of another world. It kind of denaturalizes the way things actually are, which is something that can be quite bleak, you know, when once we've read all of these things.
Yeah.
And I forgot that we also, we watched Parasite as well. And we watched this documentary, Life in Debt, which was about Jamaica, the consequences of free trade on Jamaica, and pair that with Jamaica Kincaid's A Small Place, which is about Antigua. So
yes.
It's also kind of like effects of colonialism. But so it can all feel very bleak, you know. And I think The Dispossessed kind of offers this really richly imagined possibility of another world. And I think that it feels like that, you know, not that, you know, I think she wants that, Le Guin wants you to take it as a prescription of, you know, this is how things should be. But the denaturalization of the way things are, and there is a kind of just like hope, I think there's a sort of faith, which I think, and hope is distinguished from optimism. And I think that that's actually quite
in what sense, how do you do that?
I think, so I actually come back to this line from A Raisin in the Sun. There's a character, Joseph Asagai, who's this Nigerian student who's kind of a suitor for the younger sister. And they have this conversation about, whether it's kind of worth trying to do anything, because she's this moment of disillusionment because they've just lost all the money. And so she wants to go to medical school and now her dreams are dashed.
Oh, yeah.
And she's sort of like, what's the point? You can't get close enough to what ails the world. She wants to be a doctor in order to cure the ills of the world.
Yeah.
Just, there's nothing that can cure the ills of the world. And he kind of says, well, it's, he sort of basically ends up saying, you know, but you think that we're kind of moving around like a circle. Oh, she has this image of people kind of parading around in a circle, holding up a mirror to their faces. And he says, it's not a circle, it's actually a line kind of extending infinitely outward. And, we have to sort of, and I think I take that to just mean that the future is open, that the future isn't determined.
Right.
And he's not at all naively optimistic again, you know, he's talking about this in the context of his own kind of wanting independence for Nigeria. And he kind of says, and she says, well, what about all the corrupt, you know, Nigerians who will then just rule instead of the British, you know, post-independence? What happens after that? And he says, you know, yes, like this is a very real risk and a very real possibility, but we have to take it. And he says, you know, perhaps I will be killed in my own bed by, you know, the next generation of people if my ideas have kind of atrophied and I've ceased to be, useful, but kind of so be it. And I think I feel like that vision of the line, it's very easy to think of it as just a sort of that it's about progress. And I find the students often just think, okay, it means that we're progressing, we're moving on this upward trajectory. And I think it's just about the openness of the future.
That
I think is what hope is about, some sense of the openness of the future without any expectation of things going well, or sort of with the full awareness of how terribly they could go. I mean, it's like an awareness of the contingency of history, I think, is...
And that you'll have to continually probably readjust your expectations.
Which
is really hard. So you don't focus on the future. This is what it's supposed to look like. You have to keep on revising it while you're progressing.
Yeah, and you sort of have to keep going, even though it could all end in disaster and it could all go wrong. So I think there's that spirit of in the dispossessed as well, and it's another reason why I think it's important to end sort of on that note. So there's no guarantee. There's no even reason to think it's going to end well. But nevertheless, somehow you have to kind of keep going.
Do you think your students, sort of our students this generation, I think they're being told a lot of times because of climate change, things are too late.
Mm-hmm.
And it really frustrates me to no end to tell them it's too late.
Yeah.
Which is sort of this double kind of cynical, like, oh, we screwed up.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right.
And it's too late for you.
Right.
Which is really weird. It takes both the opportunity for them to do anything away and also kind of says we were so awful.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this
mm-hmm.
we are self-aggrandizing. We screwed up the world totally.
Right.
So too late, it means nothing in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it can't be too late for anybody. I mean, it's not too late for them.
Right.
It's too late for us, maybe.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, you sort of have to keep going, even though and behaving like it's not too late, because otherwise what's the point? You
just
go to bed and go home.
And to go back full circle to sort of this idea, you know, we are attached to sort of silly things also.
Like
we sort of want things. You know, we all want things.
Right.
And we live in a culture where we want new things all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
A new phone, a new this, a new that, an upgrade or something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you have a way to respond to that for the students, to explain to them what that cycle is or does with them?
Because
it seems to be less about the objects than about...
Right.
Continually staying on your toes to be excited about new things.
Right.
Like it's a different kind of newness.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's come up so much. I mean, I think you can see that very much in someone like Emma Bovary, you know, who really sort of has that kind of desire for novelty that I also feel like is really exacerbated by capitalism and by, you know, advertising the profusion of things that we have access to. But I mean, I do this exercise at the very beginning in the first class, and I think, you know, I'll do it again in the last class, where I ask them to just kind of, we do a word cloud where they just put in, like, I ask them, what to you is a good life?
Yeah.
So there's a question of what's the fantasy, what's our collective fantasy, or cultural fantasy, I should say, of the good life, and what to you is a good life? And, you know, for most of course, you know, this is... You know, it's anonymous, but it's still, it's an exercise in a class, et cetera. So maybe they're not putting what they would actually put in if they were to answer this privately. But the answers are very much, most of them are kind of focused around like personal relationships, like health, like family, like love, like feeling understood. I mean, you know, I think these things that we all that we all want, and then like basic, like you know, economic stability, like having enough. That is something I notice a lot is there's an idea of enoughness and sufficiency in that word cloud versus when we do the word cloud for kind of cultural fantasies of the good life.
Right.
There's much more emphasis on abundance.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So you know. I mean, I think sufficiency.
Yeah.
is kind of...
But that's a great opposition, abundance versus
mm-hmm.
enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, what would enough mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think everybody is aware that we know we don't have enough, but we know we're being told we don't have enough.
Right.
It's not really our own desire so much.
Right, right. Yeah,
That enough has been... We've been sold that enough is kind of standstill.
Right.
Like, if you have enough, you're dead.
Right.
It's like a kind of, you know, there's like the death drive or something in spaces.
Yeah. And there is something about desire, right, that you kind of, you do kind of perpetually want. And that is kind of, you know, libidinal. I mean, I guess if you want to use a psychoanalytic framework, but I'm kind of struck by how the idea of sufficiency can actually be, you know, and we think about something like contentment versus happiness,
right?
I mean, I think there as well, it's an idea of sufficiency as not just like some kind of like boring compromise, but actually, you know, in the way that in the term that self-sufficiency or something, it's about sort of independence and autonomy and actually, having...
When you live in California, do you think any of these Californian ideas, these kind of, which are dismissed in a very facile way, I think that this is where sort of New Age, a certain kind of Eastern philosophy came on, like the hippie movement.
Right.
I think these movements were quite important in America, actually.
Yeah,
I think that they're eclipsed as stupid stoners is really wrong in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a sense to think contentment.
Yes.
With where you are.
Yes, yes.
Like being in the present, being present. All of these kind of Alan Watts bringing Buddhism to America, which I actually like Alan Watts a lot.
Because
he got it.
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think I'm probably influenced by those ideas. I mean, I have a meditation practice and, you know, I would have interested in Buddhist thought. I'm very aware of all of the kind of, you know, peculiarities of Western Buddhism.
Right.
And I think now it's sort of even less the kind of countercultural hippie version as the kind of Silicon Valley, like mindfulness version that is, you know, everywhere. And so there have been some critiques as well of, you know, the way that mindfulness has been adopted by the companies, you know, so you're just encouraging, employees to practice like mindfulness and stress reduction so that they can be more productive, you know, so that, and this is the critiques are often that this is once again a kind of assigning a personal responsibility to what actually are larger structural problems.
Right.
I totally see that. And I think it's true that the way mindfulness gets deployed or, you know, and that's actually often mindfulness is in those contexts often totally divorced from Buddhist thought and Buddhist philosophy. But, you know, I also think that we have a lot to learn from other systems of thought and that, you know, there are non-facile. I mean, I'm also not a scholar of Buddhism, but, you know, there are non-facile ways and that, you know, people in other cultures have thought very deeply about what the good life is and, you know, do entail some of these notions.
And I also think the opposition between, you're just being told to do mindfulness, to be more productive as a member of your corporation. You also have to live in a way. I think to say you have to overthrow the corporation or these structures are not working anymore, which is, that may well be true.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can live your life by sort of railing against the system already.
Right. Like you also kind of have to just get by. Like you have to kind of survive. And, and that's true for most of us, right? I mean, who are not in positions of power
and especially
or who are not revolutionaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think especially if you're very disenfranchised by certain structures, then you should have every recourse to actually help yourself as an individual.
Totally.
And not just be told, that's foolish. You're just getting something nice for your next 5 hours, but you should really fight the system.
Yes, I think this is kind of the same thing. Like, it's not enough to just sort of have the critical like,
superstructure.
You do need to sort of recognize that people need to like make it through life. Like, people need to make it through their day.
Right.
You know, including in your shitty jobs. And I don't know. Yeah. So I think like it's not enough to just sort of castigate people if they're not wanting to, you know, overthrow everything. And, and so it's kind of coming back to that same, like, non-contempt.
Right. It sounds like a fantastic class.
Yeah.
Fantastic class. It's actually, it's actually rare that I've really gotten, I feel like it's a sort of, I want to reread every text, and I really think it's such like an amazing class for them to go through, and it is a bit of a trajectory.
Yeah.
Without giving them an easy way out to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the hope. Anyway, I really enjoy teaching it, and the students have both, the last time and this time have been really fantastic. And, so I think it's, it's a topic that we're all interested in, right? I mean, it just like we're all trying to figure this out.
Yeah, and I love the fact, that's why I wanted to talk to you, because I love the fact also to teach it as an intro to the humanities or to comparative literature, because it's not, these texts are not useful for us.
Right.
But they do model and show something that we haven't resolved.
Right.
From like Antigone to Ursula Le Guin, like we have no idea really what's going on, which is also to me really interesting. We have no idea what's going on with us, with ourselves even.
Right.
Which is,
no.
Like that's what's so strange to me. The subject has been theorized so much, but we really don't quite know.
Right.
So I want to thank you. This has been a really fantastic conversation. For our listener, this was a conversation with Professor Dora Zhang, who is Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California at Berkeley. Your book, again, is Strange Likeness, Description in the Modernist Novel. You publish everywhere, so people can find you online. Do you have a social media presence?
I am on Twitter. Yeah.
You're on Twitter, and what's your Twitter handle?
It's Dora, and then there's two underscores, Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G. Yeah.
Dora, two underscores, Z-H-A-N-G. So follow Dora on Twitter, please. Yes, we do actually say that. And thank you so much for listening to the podcast today.